Now, this is Box to Box with Rob Gilbert and Derek Dyson.
Oh, what a goal!
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
Absolutely fantastic!
Hello and welcome to Box, the show that is everything football. Here with Rob Gilbert and Derek Dyson to run the rule over the past week in the World Game. Our good friend Michael Edgley is travelling to Hong Kong on business. You'll be hearing from him at the end of the show. He's filed from Hong Kong. And Willem van Denderen taking the week off in Scotland, the home of the ancestors, or some of Derek's ancestors at the very least. A cheerio to you as well. But first up, the future of the Newcastle Jets and Canberra United beyond this season lies in the hands of their current owners. After A-League chairman Stephen Conroy last week said the competition is no longer in a position to prop up struggling clubs. Since early 2021, the Jets have been funded by a consortium of four fellow A-League club owners after the licence was stripped from former owner Martin Lee. Now, Canberra United, meanwhile, have been left in limbo during attempts to bring a men's team to the competition for season 2024-25, which would also assume the women's licence currently held and operated by Capital Football. No one covers the entrails of the A-League closer than our good mate Joey Lynch from ESPN, The Guardian, and anywhere else you get good football content. I'll have a one-on-one chat with him shortly to see if this is just a game of high-stakes brinksmanship from a seasoned politician, or are both clubs genuinely on the brink. Then, with the Euros only 80 days away, the final qualification matches take place this week after last week's penultimate playoff phase, with Greece travelling to Tbilisi to take on Georgia. Ukraine, for obvious reasons, unable to host the match, playing in Warsaw against Ireland, while at the same time, the Polish national side will take on Wales at Cardiff City Stadium. Each of these matches has its own special narrative, as do the nations playing in them. But we're going to take a look at the post, Gareth Bale Welsh, through the eyes of the man who covers them for the BBC, Duffield Pritchard. So, Derek, it's just you and me this week. We'll hear a bit from Edge later on. But your thoughts on what's been another busy week in football?
Thanks, Rob. Yeah, it's now over to international football mainly. Of course, there are other leagues still available. There was some exciting stuff in the Women's Super League over in England, but it is the international men's stuff that's been hitting the headlines. And in between some lackluster friendly games, there's been some great competitive action too, and you know, plenty at stake in the week ahead, whether it's Wales or Ukraine or a number of other teams that are going to try and book their place in the Euros. Only 60 days, and that's incredible.
80 days.
So that 80. I mean, but the time they get through this, it's not a lot really to go and book your accommodation, book your training facilities, work out whereabouts you are. I'm sure they've done all their homework and they're just hovering over the booking.com, reserve now. But yeah, interesting times for those countries for sure.
Yeah, it sure is, as it is interesting times for our home countries, the Matildas and the Socceroos, of course. Now, Edge is going to give us a little contribution, as I mentioned off the top, from Hong Kong. He's had a look at the Matildas' road to what we hope will be their first Olympic medal without Sam Kerr. That's another story altogether. So they've been drawn alongside the USA and Germany on Thursday morning last week. Tony Gustafsson's side will later be joined by either Zambia or Morocco, who face an Africa playoff over two legs next month. So the Matildas are going to be hoping, as we saw firsthand, to build on what was an excellent World Cup. Finished fourth, didn't get onto the podium, and you know, probably was an underwhelming effort in Tokyo in 2020. So we're going to hear from Edge, as I say, Derek, but this Olympics, there won't be any England or Great Britain side in it, but that is a pretty tough group when you're looking at playing both the USA, who will be in their first outing under the auspices of their new manager, and the German side, who managed to make the final of the Euros last time around.
Oh, it's a pig of a group. I suppose the old convention is you've got to beat the best if you want to win, but at the same time, you know, I'm sure the other nations will be going, oh, goodness me, or stronger words, scheisse, to seeing Australia in their group. And there'll be no building your way through the group stage to peak in the tournament. All of these teams are going to have to peak from game one, essentially, and it will be, you know, nip and tuck. It could come down to goal difference. There's, you know, so many different permutations. So, yeah, I mean, it's a pig of a draw, but you know, you got to win, you got to beat the best, and they're just going to have to do it from game one.
Yeah, we'll hear from Mitch later on. And Emma Hayes, in her first outing with the US Women's National side, she'll definitely have a point to prove. So watch this space. Now, the Socceroos, they beat Lebanon 2-0 in Parramatta on Thursday. I thought that the Lebanese side were pretty good value in that opening side. I know they're not at the level of an Australian national side. Keanu Backus and Kyra all sealed the points. Graham Arnold would have been a bit disappointed with the lack of fluency in that match. But the Lebanese, they really stepped up and could easily have scored a goal if not nicked a point from that tie.
Yeah, the certainly, I know Edge was raving about the game on our WhatsApp group, and particularly the performance of Aiden Hristic. Australia needs to be putting these teams away for fun, with all due respect to Lebanon. And, you know, when they're playing quote unquote more illustrious opponents, they have to be a bit more gritty. You'd expect in these games that they can kind of unfurl more attacking play. But maybe that's hard. Maybe it's hard to be transitioning from being, you know, very energetic, competitive, compact teams against some of the top teams in Asia and the world. And then you come up against a team that sets up very defensively and puts a wall in front. And maybe Australia just doesn't have the fluency or the tools to break them down. But, you know, like on paper, they did the bare minimum that was required. I think everyone will hope for better performances coming forward.
Yeah, well, hats off to the Lebanese. I thought they were very good. And as we record, we haven't watched the Tuesday night game, but we'll talk to Joey about that shortly. And I wish the Cedars all the very best. I want Australia to get through, of course, and do well. But nice to see a country that that battles these days to give some joy to the people and so many of the diaspora just packing the stadium at Parramatta and selling out in Canberra. It was an excellent thing to see. Now, the young Socceroos have advanced to the final of the West Asian Football Federation Under 23 Championship following a 2-1 victory over Iraq and then a penalty shootout success against Egypt. It was excellent. Both Kuol brothers found the net at the tournament, while Brighton goalkeeper Stephen Hall made two saves during the shootout. The side will play South Korea in the final again on Tuesday evening, 7 a.m. Wednesday morning our time, if you can find it on the telly. Strong preparation for next month's Olympic qualifiers. So, Derek, there's a real good chance with this under 23 side, which we didn't have massive expectations for, to actually join the Matildas in the Paris Olympics.
Well, it'd be fantastic if they both got there, and that this is really where it all starts. If you're going to become a Socceroo, and these tournaments do provide you with amazing exposure to really high profile competitive football. You know, these aren't under 21 championships that we focus on, but the mass proportion of the population are not focused on those. But when it comes to the Olympics, you know, huge broadcasting deals, lots of eyeballs over here, and everyone will be behind that team if they can make it there. So yeah, look, as much as we love the Tillies, it'd be great to see the fellas do the job too.
Yeah, and managed by Australian football royalty Tony Vidmar. So if anybody's got a bit of experience about negotiating some of these tricky paths through tournaments, it's Tony who is iconic for his passion for the green and gold. Now, Derek, this is interesting. I'm going to expand a little more on this in stoppage time, but Arsenal's women will travel to Melbourne to meet an inaugural A-League women's all-star outfit in May. One part of a doubleheader that will also see the men's all-stars play Newcastle, but the Newcastle men's all-stars will be the scene setter for the women's match, which is, I think, fantastic. So this is May 24 at Marvel Stadium, and then we'll see Newcastle play Ange Postecoglou's Tottenham two nights prior at the MCG. So, I know we've criticised some of these exhibition matches over the journey, but that's probably because we've had so many men's exhibition matches over time. But to hit the zeitgeist and deliver a women's all-star match and then have the sensibility to have it as the main draw card at Marvel Stadium, I think this is a pretty clever move.
I think it's the more interesting game, if I'm being honest. I know the All-Premier League tie in men will be the biggest draw card. Oh, God, at the end of a long Premier League season, I'd just be very interested to see who either team puts forward, whether Son or Bruno Guimaraes or people like that will be. I think if they're fit, I would imagine all three of Arsenal's Australian players will play, and they are key players in the team as well. So, look, I'm interested to go down to watch that game on a number of different levels now. Probably wouldn't have done in my pre-box to box, but certainly the appetite for the women's game has grown since we've done this show. Obviously, the raised profile of the women's game, the Australian players, the fact that 60,000 of my fellow Arsenal fans see fit to fill up Emirates Stadium on a nearly weekly basis. You know, why wouldn't I if I had the chance? I'm disappointed I can't take my girl because it's at 8 o'clock at night. I just don't see how I make that one work. But I'm open to going with anyone else if they're going. So let me know.
I think we will be getting down there, mate. And of course, you know, as I said, I will expand on this a little later on. But it'll be great to see the Australian women's players that play for the mighty Gunners. Of course, Steph Catley, Kyra Cooney Cross, and Caitlin Ford in that side playing against the team from the competition where they cut their teeth. Now, I know we've already referred to this. We're going to expand on it a little later in the show. The Euro qualifiers, the final three places will be decided on Wednesday morning. The 2004 winners, Greece, are just a win away from their first appearance since 2012. They beat Kazakhstan 5-1 and set up that tie against Georgia. So Wales and Poland, which is the match we'll talk to Dufford Pritchard about, will be playing in Cardiff. Each had big wins in that penultimate qualifier against Finland, 4-0, and Estonia, respectively. And Ukraine will host Iceland in Warsaw in Poland, still displaced from their home nation. Iceland's Albert Gudmundsson scoring a hat-trick in their win over Brazil. Now, other international friendlies, I do want to talk about this a little more. So I might just reserve your opinion on this match for stoppage time. So if you want to hear Derek's more expansive thoughts on the England-Brazil friendly, because he did give us some insights into his hopes for the team he loves to hate, the Three Lions, of course, but they weren't able to get the job done against Brazil, a second-string Brazil, as it was described by many. And we saw another prodigy, Endrick, he became the youngest player to score at Wembley as they beat England 1-0. 17 years, 246 days, the Palmeiras youngster, they're just 9 minutes from being introduced to score the winner and become Brazil's youngest goal scorer since Ronaldo in 1994. But elsewhere in Bratislava, Austria's Christoph Baumgartner broke Lukas Podolski's record for the fastest international goal scoring just 6 seconds into their 2-0 win over Slovakia. And again, I'll talk a bit more about the irony of that happening on the very same day that a German young gun scored a goal after just 7 seconds. Now, Socceroos Matildas central for the Green and Gold Army. Now is the time to book your trip to Paris for the 2024 Olympics with the Matildas out to finally claim that elusive medal we talked about. It's going to be a magnificent trip. If you want to get to the Olympics, the fact that this draw has delivered Australia matches in Marseille in particular, and Nice as well, which is a beautiful city on the French Riviera. If you haven't been there, head to ggatravel.com.au. Now, in the English Women's Super League, both Mary Fowler and Alana Kennedy started for Manchester City as they kept the pressure on league leaders Chelsea, who beat West Ham themselves. That result was a 3-1 win over Manchester United, while all their three Aussies came off the bench at Arsenal in their 3-1 win over Villa. Claire Wheeler played a full match in the centre of the park for Everton in their 0-0 draw with Liverpool, where Tegan Mika remained on the bench while both Mackenzie Arnold and Katrina Gorry started for West Ham as they went down to Chelsea, and Mackenzie Arnold was in goals in that loss overnight against Chelsea, against the reigning champions. No international break in the MLS, where forgotten man Brad Smith scored the winner for Houston Dynamo in the 96th minute. They sit seventh in the Western Conference. And a couple of weeks ago, we spoke about how well Arthur Pappas has been tracking at Buriram United in Thailand. Now, despite sitting on top of the table, he and the club have parted ways this week. We don't know a lot more about that story, but when Edge comes back next week, we might have to ask him about it. So, Derek, we'll press pause there. Why don't you go and get yourself a cup of tea? I'm going to have a one-on-one with Joey Lynch and see what he has to say about Newcastle and Canberra, get a bit of an insight into the Socceroos matches against Lebanon. So, take a pause, mate, and that'll be coming up next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box, and it's not often we have the luxury of doing a one-on-one these days, but with Edge travelling and Willem playing AFL football in Scotland of all players, it's over to me to have a yarn to our next guest, our good mate from ESPN, The Guardian, and just about anywhere else you'll find good football content, Joey Lynch. How are you, Joey?
I'm going well. Thanks for having me back on, mate.
Mate, it's always a pleasure. Now, we did get you on to mainly talk about the drama within the A-League men's and women's competition around the Jets and Canberra, just to dig a little bit deeper to find out whether, you know, is this a game of brinksmanship from Stephen Conroy and the executive level of the A-League, or is it an existential crisis for both clubs? But before we do, anyone who's listening carefully will hear a bit of the hubbub of background football noise. We're talking to you from the bowels of the Bruce Stadium ahead of the second, well, it's the home tie for Lebanon, isn't it, against the Socceroos?
Indeed it is. Lebanon, like Palestine in this group as well, unable to play games in their homelands due to the conflict in the region. So they negotiated to play this game in Australia, which made sense, I guess, in the end. They were going to be here anyway, so they didn't need to travel and go through the expense of more international flights and the like. So, yeah, tomorrow evening, Canberra, Australia's capital, will turn into Lebanon's home game.
Exactly, downtown Beirut. And it's a sellout too. Anyone who's listened to this show for long enough will know that I'm very proud of my Lebanese heritage. My mother came from the small village of Hardin before the Second World War when she was 5 years old. I did a little feature in our Stoppage Time episode last week on Lebanon. And, you know, as an Australian with Lebanese heritage, like so many people of an immigrant background in Australia, I do straddle my loyalties when it comes to games like this. I'll follow the red and gold in anything else, but equally, I was just as much behind the Cedars in Parramatta, which is just down the road from where I grew up in Guildford, and just so pleased and proud to see the flag flying for positive reasons. And look, a lot of people might have considered Lebanon cannon fodder for Australia on, you know, an inevitable sort of march through qualifying, but I watched it. It definitely wasn't the case. Whether it was Graham Arnold's side a little bit off their best or Lebanon rising to the occasion, I really thought they would have been good value for at least one goal. And towards the end of the game, in the second half, they certainly had more shots on goal, could have easily drawn that game.
Yeah, they did. I think you are right in the sense that it was both probably not the best day at the office for the Socceroos and also the Lebanese. Certainly grew into that game, I would say. Obviously, going down a goal within 5 minutes, not ideal for any sides, especially one coming all the way across to Australia and having to take on the Socceroos. But they were able to regather. Both of the goals that they conceded weren't really of the sort one would describe as being replicable in nature. Bacchus's, well, let's face it, he was trying to cross the ball and it got away from him on the first one, and then chaos in the box, the ball ricocheting around and Kai Rolls poking in and off the post for the second. So it wasn't like they gave up very many. Well, in fact, they arguably didn't give up any high quality chances throughout the game. So that is both reflective of the work that they did and also the long-running challenges the Socceroos have actually had in creating high quality looks on goal from open play. But they certainly didn't end up as cannon fodder for the Socceroos, even if Palestine's performance against Bangladesh in the other World Cup qualifier certainly put them up against it to progress out of this stage.
Yeah, it is definitely from someone who's got a little skin in the game on both sides, what I was thinking. I mean, insofar as the hopes and expectations of nations like Lebanon, and we know through Southeast Asia, we've seen the rise of a lot of nations, Thailand, Vietnam, to name just two. These are countries, and there are representative countries in all of the other confederations around the world who, for the critics of the expanded World Cup, would never otherwise have a realistic opportunity to plan and hope at some stage in the next coming while to genuinely have a hope of going to a World Cup. But this seems to be a game changer for that. That, to me, is one of the real positives, and that's why I've supported the expansion since it was announced.
It should certainly be interesting to see who immediately moves to fill that those extra spaces in Asia. If you were looking at it, I think ever since, I think it's the 2002 World Cup, only two nations outside of the big five of Australia, Saudi Arabia, Korea, Japan and Iran have actually qualified out of Asia for the World Cup. That was China and North Korea just once. So there certainly are, there's certainly been a monopolization of the slots on offer at the world's biggest sporting event coming out of Asia. And it is certainly going to give a lot more impetus to a lot of sides that are maybe sitting on the bubble. You're thinking about nations like Qatar, who, yes, they were there at the last World Cup, but they've never actually qualified on the footballing pitch in their history. It was Uzbekistan that have been sinking a lot of money into their junior national team programs. Iraq, who have had a lot of success at maybe Asian Cup level, but we haven't seen them as much on the World Cup stage. Even nations like the United Arab Emirates, who Australia needed to beat in a Asian playoff to even earn the right to face off against Peru in the last World Cup qualifier. And then you do have these nations that maybe you wouldn't consider them to be consistent challenges for those extra spaces. But I guess with the introduction of 8.5 places for Asian sides of the World Cup now, it's for nations like Syria, Tajikistan after their most recent Asian Cup escapades, and indeed maybe a nation like Lebanon or Palestine to put together a good run of form and challenge for one of these extra spaces on hand, even if, as I said, it looks like Palestine and Lebanon are battling for one of those. Well, they are battling for that other slot in Group I of this phase of Asian qualifying at the moment.
It seems so. And before we move on, the match in Canberra, it'll be Tuesday evening our time as this podcast drops. Are you expecting a more chastened Socceroos outfit to be a little more professional from the opening whistle? They're missing a few players, some injuries, or do Lebanon, with a full house, who I suspect will largely be partisan towards the home side, or visitors in their case, the Cedars. What's your thoughts on and expectations on that game?
I don't think Australia will be chastened so much, because I think Australia is as Australia does, so to speak. We sort of know what to expect from the Socceroos. We know what they're good at. We know what their weaknesses are. We know that the Socceroos are going to be very strong defensively. They're going to run all night. They're going to be very together. We know that they are more than likely going to struggle to create high-quality chances on goal. And we will just, I guess, have to see what breaks on that front. There are going to be four or five changes in the Australia lineup. Very keen to see what they actually are. Craig Goodwin's back. Aidan Thrustic got through about 50-odd minutes last week, and he's one of these creative players that can really spark a side. So it's going to be very interesting to see what we get from the Socceroos. I guess there won't be so much surprises in terms of how they play. It's more so just, are they able to connect on these final balls? Are they actually able to start to unlock a defence? Because they've got the talent there. They've got the ability to do so. We'll just have to see whether or not it comes off on the night.
Okay, we'll watch this space. On to the main topic of discussion, Joey. And whilst we've had what appeared to be some good news over the last month or so in Perth and New Zealand with the expansion side, as it inevitably is the case in football in this country, the pendulum swings the other way, and we see Stephen Conroy, the chairman of the A-Leagues, who we've been waiting to come out and make some public statement and show a public-facing side of his role as chairman. This seems to have been the most publicity he's gathered since he took over the role by talking about the Newcastle Jets and the Canberra story in the last week, where he quote in your article and a number of others says, you know, I always enjoy commercial negotiations when people try and leverage through the newspapers, this deal's been on and off, etc. So is this a game of brinksmanship, in your opinion, Joey? Are we looking at a genuine scenario where we may not see Newcastle in the next A-League men's or women's competition, or that the bid that he talks about having not yet received from Canberra men not materialising at all?
I think it is a genuine possibility that the Newcastle Jets won't be in the A-League next season because, as Stephen Conroy has pointed out, the APL is not in a position to bail out clubs. They're in if the current owners that have taken over custodianship of the club are unable to sell and they withdraw their own support. The Newcastle Jets simply cannot function. They won't have anybody backing them. Ergo, they will not have a team. So that is a definitive possibility because the APL have come out and nailed their colours to the mast. They will not bankroll them anymore. They're not in a position to do so. So we do have to acknowledge that it is a real possibility. Now the question more so is it likely to happen? I think on the Canberra front, there's talk about that bids are very close. It's in the hands of the Foreign Investment Review Board and AUSTRAC to just sign off on the catch. So it's taken significantly longer than anybody would have liked, and it probably has been rather more opaque than certainly most people would have liked, and probably more opaque than the Canberra United players deserved, given how they've sort of been left in limbo by this. It has been unfair on them as they try to figure things out, but it seems like that is going to get over the line. The Jets, the latest reports in the Newcastle Herald are that the consortium, the FC32 consortium that was initially involved in the bidding process, they have flown representatives in to Australia this week in an attempt to spur the process that was going on. So one might argue that Stephen Conroy's coming out and nailing his colours to the mast, saying that somebody has to fund the Jets because otherwise they won't exist. Maybe that has spurred activity, and maybe the brinksmanship has worked, so to speak, because it's forced the parties to come back to the table and to keep negotiating. And the reports are that there are other parties now involved. Maybe perhaps the custodians in charge of the Jets currently realising that, well, we have to sell it because the APL aren't going to take it off our hands. And if we pull out our funding and we don't sell it and the Jets cease to exist, we're certainly not getting any of our money back. I don't think it's possible that they're getting all of the money they've sunk into running that club since they took over the license from Martin Lee, but there's still the possibility they'll get something back if they sell it versus nothing if they don't sell it and they have to pull out. I think, obviously, Conroy coming out very strongly, it probably did put a few noses out of joint, but to be honest, I think it was something that it probably should have happened a long time ago, not just surrounding expansion, but on most matters. The A-Leagues, certainly since those mass redundancies earlier in the year, have probably been operating rather silently. They've been operating in the background. We haven't heard that much from them. So in the sense that Stephen Conroy actually just coming out and saying, here's the APL's position, here's what we can do, here's what we cannot do, here's how we currently see things. Obviously, it got noses out of joint and probably a lot of people don't like it, but at least he actually said something. At least we actually heard from the APL. That is a positive. I spoke to Nick Garcia that same day. That is a positive that they are actually coming out and answering questions. I think one of the A-League's biggest problems has been that the narrative has gotten away from the APL. Conroy came out saying that he didn't, he's always a fan of negotiations taking place through the newspapers. Well, the only reasons that things such as anonymous sources in the newspapers are able to gain as much headway as they are is because nature abhors a vacuum. The Australian footballing public abhors a vacuum. And there was a vacuum of information out there about what was going on. So the fact that Stephen Conroy has come out and gone out to fill it, at least obviously people can quibble with the content of it. God knows I quibble with a lot about some of the APL's direction. I've nailed my colours to the mast on numerous occasions about where I see the game going. But at least he came out and said something. At least we actually got some sort of definitive statement about where things were from the game's administrators, and that seemingly has moved the process along.
Yeah, it's definitely the political 101 activity on Conroy's behalf. So if he does end up, well, not he, but if the Jets do get saved, and some of it is attributed to him ripping the Band-Aid off in the less than subtle way that he's done, then he'll be considered to be the winner, or the A-Leagues will be considered to be the winner as a result of this. But
I think Jets fans don't care how the club is saved, as long as it's saved.
Question though, Joey, I mean, we know that there's this deal that's been talked about from the former Nike executive Paul Francis that you were reported on in the Newcastle Herald. Are they asking for too much? I mean, is there a point that you get to where you say that the commercial deal for television is not going to increase? The money that they want is not necessarily going to equate to the money that they can get. I mean, the price is the price. You're not going to get a buyer stumping up more than what they're prepared to pay.
I guess that's the thing. What is the market value of the Jets? Well, it's probably whatever you can convince somebody to pay for them. I guess that is the beauties of capitalism, and the A-Leagues have nailed their colours to the mast in the form that this is a private, for-profit, capitalistic enterprise. Mm. So, I don't know. Like, I've always been, you know, the exact opposite of this. Like, if we are going to exist in this model wherein there are private franchises that operate within a closed system with no promotion and relegation, and we are going to pick where we put clubs less on sporting merit and more based upon market sizes and all of these other things, I have always thought that if you are seeking to bring in new owners and you are seeking to expand, the most important thing is finding people that are going to make ongoing commitments to funding clubs and backing clubs and actually ensuring that they are viable and sustainable. I know the A-League seemingly have, dating back to the days of Football Australia, when the previous regimes at Football Australia, then Football Federation Australia, brought in the highest bidders through this Western United and MacArthur process. License fees have always propped up thoughts of expansion in recent days, and I get that because you need to bring in funding, because let's face it, the A-Leagues are not flush with cash. But if I was running things, it would purely be about, as seemingly has occurred at Perth Glory with Ross Pellegria, paying less for a license fee on the assumption that he will take on amounts of debt that the club owes and sink a requisite amount of funding into the club. I always thought that was the better model of bringing in club owners, especially.
Well, speaking of clubs that the A-League doesn't own, you've already alluded to it and the challenges that the Canberra club has in giving some certainty to its players. The woman of the moment, Michelle Heyman, no sooner has she come out and put her star back in the firmament for the Matildas, but she's been quoted as saying that delays selling the club bid for the men's side might force her and some other players to seek opportunities elsewhere. I mean, what do we know of this from the inside, Joey?
Well, it's just pretty much what Michelle Heyman is saying, because players, we need to remember that the A-League women's season, the regular season, certainly it's coming to an end very soon. Canberra aren't going to play finals football, so their season will in fact end this week. And these players have careers, they have futures, and it's not just in matters of football. Yes, they need to sign contracts, they need to figure out where they're going to be. They can't afford to wait around for Canberra for too long, because they need certainty. But it's beyond that. There's questions of, like, some of these players rent, some of these players need to sign leases. If Canberra United isn't going to have another sign next season, but they've signed a 12-month lease in the nation's capital for a house, what are they supposed to be doing? If they are going to move to Adelaide or Melbourne, what are they supposed to do on accommodation surrounding that? So that's the challenge presenting down a lot of these Canberra players. It's not just about the football, but it's their lives. A lot of players have jobs outside of the A-League. Do these players need to start looking for work in Melbourne or Brisbane or Perth or West or Adelaide or these sort of things? There are so many considerations that these players have that they need to address, which is why I say it's probably been unfair on them. We are hearing that the Canberra deal is close, and for the future of a A-League's women franchise in Canberra, the best long-term, the most viable long-term solution is for that bid to get over for the line, and for them to commence operations. We don't know what will happen with the Canberra United branding, whether that will continue. One would expect that any new franchise owners that have stumped up money to come to Canberra will want to claim ownership of their shiny new toy. So that will be inevitably a matter of contention. But we have seen that Capital Football, it has been reported by people on the ground in the ATC, Capital Football, they want out. They cannot afford to continue to fund this Canberra United program year on year on year. There is a program, there is a board meeting actually tonight, so a board meeting will have occurred by the time this podcast goes out to discuss the future of the Canberra United license as it currently stands. If an A-League's license isn't sold in Canberra, what will happen to Canberra United for next season? Because as I said, the APL has already nailed their colours to the mast. They cannot afford, and they will not be propping up a Canberra United side for the next A-League women's season. So there is a petition right now extolling Capital Football to commit to funding the program if an A-League's franchise doesn't come in. So it really is a situation wherein, if I was had to make a prediction, my prediction would be that a new franchise comes in and operates an A-League's women's program next season. But Canberra United players can't sign a rental agreement based upon my predictions. And that's the situation we find ourselves in right now.
Well, Joey, you wrote in one of your other articles a couple of weeks ago that if it's a day ending in Y, the A-League must be experiencing yet another existential inflection point. It never ends, does it, Joey?
No, it does. It's well, it would be boring otherwise, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would be. But we love it, and football will survive regardless of whatever happens. I'm not going to be as juvenile as to ask you to pull out a crystal ball and take a guess at what might happen with the Jets or Canberra, because it is just guesswork. So,
well, I could guess. My guess is they're both sold. They're both okay. Here next season. Oh. I mean, maybe that's hope as well, because you don't like to see clubs folding. But my guess is they're both here next season. Yeah, I couldn't tell you what they'll be called. I couldn't tell you what the Canberra team will be called, but my guess is they're both here next season.
Yeah, well, thanks for answering my rather juvenile non-question. But the fact, as we already sort of canvassed in this conversation, is that the price is the price. The buyer will set the price ultimately by either paying it or walking away. And
and it's a sunk cost. If the owners can't sell it, they're not getting that money back either way. It's already what they've invested into the Jets is already a sunk cost.
Yeah.
So they might as well get something out of it. The process hasn't been run well, but they might as well try to find a silver lining.
Okay. Well, let's see if Stephen Conroy can have a win at his first at-bat. And if he does, well, you know, he might not be a hero, but at least he'll be recognised for having done something of value. So let's see if something is as critical as the clubs that represent the national side is surviving in the national women's and men's competition is an outcome of all of this. Joey, we will find out. And we will talk to you about it. We'll probably read you reporting on what the end result is, and that's where we will find out. Because in the absence of the lamented keep up, there is more and more limited content of which we attempt through our humble podcast to contribute to the story. You do excellent work with ESPN and The Guardian and everywhere else you contribute, mate. So for football fans, we and those in the community who listen to our show, we hope we've given you a bit of an insight and commentary and observations all in one go. And we thank you for it, Joey. And while you're in Canberra, it's probably not as chilly as it will get in coming months, but
No, it's pretty hot today, actually. But I will just say on that front, if people are after extra coverage of Australian football, I do also have a Substack.
Yes.
I have started up and I do write on that. It's mostly, well, good old-fashioned beat reporting, actually covering the football for a change of the Melbourne sides. You can find that. It's called JDL Media. So you can find that at jdlmedia.substack.com. The best way to stay tuned with that is to subscribe to it, because unfortunately Substack links get suppressed on Twitter because Elon Musk had an argument with the founders of Substack. So they're suppressed on your news feeds. But if you do want more Australian coverage, people can subscribe to that as well.
So just repeat that one for us one more
time. So it's JDL Media on Substack, jdlmedia.substack.com.
And one of your colleagues at The Guardian, Jamie Jackson, who is the man, or one of the men who covers the Manchester City beat and United as well. We've been talking about his Substack over recent months as well. So, you know, if you just really want to get quality content, then, you know, just like you do with Vision and just about everything else these days, it's a small contribution. You really don't have to pay a lot. I'd encourage people to just at least investigate to find out.
Well, my Substack's free to read at present. So there's a donate button on it if you are ever so kind, which you can donate by card or PayPal. But for the moment, at least it is free to read.
Well, dip your toe in and then pay. Joey, always good to talk to you, mate. Thanks again for jumping on. Enjoy that Soccer is Lebanon match, and you know, we'll have you on again soon, and we'll stay tuned. Same bad time, same bad channel for the next exciting episode of A-League Women's and Men's as it eventually unfolds.
Looking forward to it.
Joey Lynch, our good friend, ESPN, The Guardian, and Substack. Do yourself a favour and do a little bit of homework and find him there and support him there as well, because he's a great guy, a great football man, and he's one of the people that keeps the story of Australian football alive and the pulse beating. Okay, stick around after the break. Talking about pulses beating, Wales after the Gareth Bale retirement, I should say, felt that they might not be turning up at any of the big international tournaments for a while, but Robert Page looks like he's got them nearly there. They've got to play Poland at the Cardiff City Stadium in a couple of days' time. After the break, we're going to talk to David Pritchard from the BBC Wales and get his thoughts on whether they can take that final step. That's next on Box to Box. Hey, Derek, it's time to talk Chemist Warehouse. Now, you know, you're a relatively young man. You've got young kids. You know, you're a strong person. But as we do get a little bit older, I've probably got 20 years on you, mate. We need to consider our bone health and our bone density to stay strong, don't we?
Yeah, tell me more about that. Because I am at that time of life, Rob, where the invincibility cloak is starting to wear off a little bit. So I do know I need to look at these things.
Well, you see, you do, and you've got a lovely mum and dad who are a picture of health, but maybe you could recommend some of this. Austolin Cal DK2 from Chemist Warehouse. It combines calcium, vitamins D3 and vitamin K2 in one convenient daily tablet to support muscle function and maintain bone density, particularly important for the beautiful women in our lives who, as they age, for various reasons, the calcium density in their bones isn't as strong as it should be. So as much as they take their dairy and calcium from other sources, it's important to get a really good supplement. So support your bone strength with Australia's number one bone health brand. Now that is sourced from the IQVIA Retail Scan Sales Total Australia, MAT10 from February 2024. Try Austolin Cal DK260 tablets from, of course, our very good friends at Chemist Warehouse. The great savings are every single day.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box. We've heard from Joey Lynch about some of the political travails going on in Australian football and, you know, some uplifting background on the Socceroos and their two-match tie against Lebanon. But on the other side of the world, the countdown is on just 80 days till the Euros. Who would have thought? Well, it's been only 3 years because of the COVID pandemic since the last Euros in England, which Italy famously beat England in the final out against at that infamous final in Wembley. So the three final matches to take up the final spots are Greece against Georgia, Ukraine, obviously the heartwarming story against Iceland. But the match that we're going to talk about next up is the one at Cardiff City Stadium against Poland. It is going to be an absolute cracker. It'll be jam-packed with singing Welshmen. And our next guest from the BBC in Wales is David Pritchard. It's been a little while since we had you on, David, but welcome back. You must be starting to feel the nerves, mate.
Thank you. Yeah. Thursday was a weirdly nerveless experience when Wales played Finland. It's not often Wales are involved in a big football match and all the anxiety is taken out of it at a pretty early stage. But they won that one pretty handsomely 4-1. But yeah, the game against Poland is going to be a different proposition altogether. Poland, a strong footballing nation, didn't have the best time in qualifying, but the same was true of Wales. So they've both had their issues during the regular qualifying campaign, but two passionate sets of fans. We've had Poland in Cardiff recently in the last couple of years, and they're brilliantly supported. So I'm sure it's going to be a pretty hostile, fierce atmosphere, but a huge occasion and one that the Welsh nation is getting pretty nervous but excited about.
At the end of the last major tournament, there was this sense that the ride that this Welsh national team had been on, which really started with Gary Speed in a way, the way he picked up the team and then transitioned through Coleman and several other managers, but felt that this ride had come to an end. They went into that tournament with a lot of optimism, didn't get the results they wanted. And Rob Page's question was definitely, future was definitely under question. So what's happened since the end of that tournament, and why have Wales suddenly put themselves back in the, one game away from a major finals again?
It's been a really testing campaign for Wales. Like you said, there's some questions about Page after the World Cup, where Wales were so disappointing. Maybe pound for pound, the worst team at the World Cup, you could argue. So they started the campaign with the desire to try and put that right, and they started quite well, drawing out in Croatia, bit of a streaky point. But it all kind of seemed to go crashing down last summer when they lost at home to Armenia, lost out in Turkey. The defeat at home to Armenia in particular was a pretty humiliating night for Wales. So Page was really on the ropes at that stage, and it looked like his future was in pretty grave danger. But they turned it around in the autumn. A great win against Croatia, one of their better performances in recent years. So it seemed like they might be turning a corner. But as we've seen with Wales under Page, they can't seem to string more than a couple of decent performances together. They ended the campaign poorly, but luckily for Wales, as is the case for Poland, they finished third outside of the automatic qualification spots. But because the expanded nature of the Euros and the fact that the Nations League performances help you out, they've got this second chance at the playoffs. And they dispatched Finland quite confidently, but yeah, Poland are going to be a completely different proposition. So it's been a real up and down campaign for Wales under Page, but you get the sense that, things have steadied a little over the last few months. And yeah, if they win, people will forget how they got there. They won't mind if it's by the backdoor route of the playoffs. Likewise, with Page's future, those questions will be put to bed. But if they lose against Poland, then as well as the disappointment of missing out on the Euros, I think those questions about Page's future will probably resurface again.
Well, one of the challenges with Poland is going to be turning the recent form around, isn't it? Because you mentioned they've played them recently. There's not a good track record there against Poland. I believe you can correct me, it's 5 or 6 games losing on the bounce. So how did Wales turn that around?
Yeah, Wales have never beaten Poland. Despite playing them, I think it's 10 times over the course of their history. And, you look at their respective histories and it's maybe not that surprising. Wales historically have not been that strong. Poland, by contrast, big populous nation, strong footballing tradition. In recent years, Wales have probably been on a similar kind of footing to Poland, similar in the world rankings. They played each other in the Nations League most recently. And the first game out in Poland, I was there for, slightly false picture of Wales because they had to play something of a reserve team for that game because It came just a few days before their World Cup playoff final against Ukraine. So Page decided to rest the vast majority of his first team players for that game. They lost narrowly 2-1. The game you can maybe take a bit more from was the home game here, September 2022. Poland again won 1-0, but it was a real tight, kind of nervy affair. Those teams were a bit more like what we'll expect to see tomorrow night. So, and then, you know, Poland will pose huge threat, as we expect them to. You know, Robert Lewandowski, 35 now, but still a huge threat, playing for Barcelona as well as Poland. The likes of Piotr Zielinski from Napoli. You know, they've got star quality everywhere you look in that squad. And whereas Wales maybe don't have the same strength on paper, the fact that they're at home is a huge advantage. They've only lost one of their last 15 Euros qualifiers, only lost 3 out of 23 overall at home. So they're pretty confident, but I get the impression Poland would be as well. So it feels like a real kind of 50-50 game.
Yeah, and a lot of the narrative around Wales is to do with the transition of the team away from the star names that were the bedrock of the success they've had getting to recent tournaments, of the most obvious one being Gareth Bale, but they've obviously got Ramsey, who's still in the squad on one leg and not a lot of minutes, and the likes of Allen and others are in the rearview mirror. But Wales are benefiting from the fact that there, I think there is competition for places. And while the players are not necessarily in the top echelons of club football in the UK or even abroad, there's a lot of players getting a lot of minutes in the Championship and the lower half of the Premier League. And that to me seems like a good bedrock for this team, not just for this game, but going forward as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You're spot on. When you're comparing Wales to where they are now to where they were, say, when they beat Ukraine in the World Cup playoff, there's a strong argument to be made that they're in a healthier position now. Rob Page made a similar point after the Finland game. Like you say, they may not be all Premier League regulars, but the problem going into the Ukraine game and other games in recent years is that Wales's first-choice players just weren't playing regularly for their clubs, and they showed that in their performances. They were sometimes slow starting, or they couldn't last the 90 minutes. They just lacked that sharpness that you get from regular game time and the rhythms that you get from playing consistent football. Whereas now, some players have had to drop down a level to get regular football. So David Brooks and Kiefer Moore both left Bournemouth in the Premier League to join Championship clubs in Southampton and Ipswich, but they're reaping the rewards because they're playing regularly, they're scoring goals, they're creating goals. And as you say, there's competition for places there now. So whereas in the past, your eyes might have been drawn to the likes of Bale and Ramsey, or anyone who watches, you know, lower Premier League or upper half Championship football, you'll see that there isn't a massive gulf between those levels. And you see the likes of Daniel James flying for Leeds at the moment, Kiefer Moore scoring goals for Ipswich, David Brooks playing well for Southampton. The fact that they're playing regularly and with confidence, they've managed to translate that into playing for Wales. So there is competition for places there. They might not have the big names that Poland have, but for once, Wales have a squad that is, yeah, for once, fully firing and fit.
The one player that is in a so-called big club and big club environment is Brennan Johnson, of course, striker for Spurs and Wales. He seems to be the one that has the highest ceiling of this current crop. Is he the sort of player that not just for this next game, but is he the sort of player that Wales can build a next team around because of the assets that he brings to that forward position? He's you know, probably, with all due respect to him, he's not going to reach Gareth Bale type levels, but there's still a high ceiling there, isn't there?
Yeah, it's a good point. And a few colleagues of mine and I made this same point. We were talking about the potential of different players, and we thought, who is the star man in this squad? And it's hard to pick one out, but that was the exact phrase we used. Brennan Johnson does seem like the guy who does have that higher ceiling because of the level he's playing with for Spurs at the moment. You know, he started off the season, or when he first joined from Forest, perhaps not a cast iron member of that first 11. But so long as you're playing every 1-in-2 or 2-in-3 games in a Spurs system with Ange Postecoglou, who favours such a fluid attacking style of play, then you'd imagine he's only going to you know, progress over the next few years. And when Bale retired, I think you're naturally looking for that next star, aren't you? You want someone to pin your hopes on. And the players have all talked about this collective responsibility to fill that void. So Harry Wilson plays in the area of the pitch where Bale occupied the most. So maybe just to the right of the front man. So cutting inside onto his left, taking set pieces. So there are comparisons there. But Brennan Johnson is maybe a bit more like Bale in open play, in the sense that he can take players on and will score, you know, inside the area as well as outside. The truth is nobody can fill that void that Bale leaves on their own, because he was just superhuman, and, you know, we'll never see his like again playing for Wales. But between them, the likes of Wilson, Johnston, you know, they could give you the attributes that go some way to filling that gap. But I think, yeah, Brennan Johnson maybe hasn't quite hit his straps for Wales, but he's a young guy. He's still only 20, 30 caps into his Wales career. The quality is there for us all to see, isn't it, at Spurs at the moment. We're just maybe starting to see that for Wales. So, yeah, the hope is definitely that he can be the main man of that Wales attack for years to come.
Just a quick word on Aaron Ramsey. I mentioned him before. I think he is in this squad, albeit with not a lot of game time under his belt, and are very, very unlikely to start this next game. Like, do you see his role as less of a active member of the first team, but really just as someone that provides continuity between that previous era of success and the new era? Or does he have any chance, do you think, of having a more active playing role in this team going forward?
I think at the moment it's more the former, you know, being that kind of continuity figure. Rob Page likes to talk about the influence Ramsey has off the pitch as much as on it. You know, he's one of the senior figures now. I think he's 33 years old now. And he's played a long time. He was 16 when he was coming through the ranks at Cardiff and playing for the first team. So he's had a long career at the top, and we know he's had injury problems over the years. So he was someone that Wales had to do without quite a lot, even in his peak years. So while he approaches maybe the kind of autumn of his career, he's definitely a less prominent figure on the pitch in the sense of just pure minutes and the amount that he's able to play. You do get the impression he's still an important player. So he was injured in November, for example, at the end of the regular qualifying campaign, but he still flew out to Armenia to be a part of the squad, to help the younger players through who might not have played in similar games before. And he loves it. He really loves being back at home with Cardiff this season. Again, injuries have stopped him from playing as much as he'd like to for his club as well. But you do get the impression he's a guy who really enjoys the responsibility of being the old head, the senior pro who the younger players can look up to. So although he's still got something to offer on the pitch, maybe if it's just a 20 or 30 minute cameo, as things stand, given his fitness situation, who knows, if they get to the Euros, he might be in a position where he's fit again to challenge. But the nice dilemma Page has is, even if Ramsey was fully fit right now, you could argue that he may not get into Wales' best 11 purely on a kind of balance side of things, because they play a kind of 3-4-3 system at the moment, and Ramsey is neither a central midfielder who can play as a two, nor is he really a kind of player who can play in the front three. He's a kind of old school number 10 who really needs to play in a midfield three or in a 4-2-3-1. So it's maybe the case that for Page at the moment, it probably suits him best that Ramsey's probably only up to playing 20 or 30 minutes, be the senior figure, still one of the main people in the group. But, you know, I think his days of being a guaranteed starter are probably gone.
And finally, I know that you guys don't often like to be drawn into your predictions, but I'm going to ask you, what do you think is going to happen? Give us a scoreline. We promise the next time you're on, we won't play it back to you. What do you think it's going to be?
Oh, it is a hard one to call. I do think both sides will fancy their chances. I think it's going to be a really hot atmosphere. I think Poland's fans were brilliant when they were last in Cardiff. I think it could be a great occasion. I think Wales need to start like they did against Finland. Fast start. And I think they'll back themselves to win. I think Poland will score, though. So let's say Wales to edge it 2-1, but I could see the game going to extra time as well, just to increase our nerves.
Well, let's hope it's the game that you're looking for, David. All the very best for the game. And yeah, we'll be cheering on Wales as they try and reach yet another major finals. That's David Pritchard from the BBC giving us excellent insights into this crucial week of Euros qualifying. Will Wales join England and the other teams that have qualified so far for the finals in Germany? All will be revealed as the week goes on. So stick around on Box to Box, where we'll be doing World Cup Corner. And we have Edge giving us his rundown of the Olympics.
Willa, willa, willa. Everybody's going to buy Hoyt's Spices. Everyone's going to save a dollar or two. Everybody's going to buy Hoyt's Spices, yeah.
Hey, Derek, you know where I was this afternoon? I was down at Hoyt's in Moorabbin. So if you're not in Melbourne and you don't know where Moorabbin is, it is in the southern suburbs, and it's where the Hoyt's empire is. Now, I call it an empire because it's a magnificent array of factories where you drive down Alex Avenue, which I always like because, short for my little fella Alexander, but you can smell the Hoyt's factory from miles off. And Derek, I know over the journey, and I'm probably not often enough, I've given you a few samples of Hoyt's, but there is someone I've been promising to supply some Hoyt's to for some time now. He's the man behind the metaphorical glass, Adam Maloney. Now, I'm just going to open this box that I picked up today from John. Oh, here we go. There, it's opening. And Adam, here we go. Italian herb mix. We've got the four-colour peppercorn mix, the famous four-colour peppercorn mix. We've got the sweet paprika. You love that, Adam's nodding and little drool. I think it's a drop of drool. I can see just sort of hanging from the edge of his beard. Himalayan pink rock salt. Oh, everything. And all some of the Hoyt's tartare sauce for Friday night fish and chips. You always need a bit of that in the fridge. I'm going to get one more because it's just too much in there to name it all. But the minced garlic. Oh, well, that's what I'm going to use tonight to make my garlic sauce. I'm going to barbecue some chicken. I'm going to get some of that minced garlic, add a little salt, and add some lemon juice and oil and make the Lebanese classic tum, the garlic sauce to go with that chicken. Derek, how does that sound, mate?
That sounds delightful, Rob, and I do like anything from that part of the world and your heritage there.
Absolutely. Well, we were talking to Joey Lynch not long ago about all of this. He's watching Lebanon play that home match, not in Beirut, but in the great Lebanese city of Canberra against the Socceroos on Tuesday night. So, hey, Johnny Yakato, big, big thank you to you for your generosity. Adam is very, very happy that he's finally got his Hoyt's back and he will enjoy it. If you haven't got your Hoyt's back, get on down to your local Woolworths, your local Coles, or your good independent supermarket. You can get it all for yourself.
Fill those empties with Hoyt's Spices, yeah.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box. It's World Cup Corner. Lovely chat with David Pritchard there. The Welsh, that lilt, you just got to love it. And the Welsh side, Poland would deserve to get there, but it'd be nice to see another one of those home nations make it there, particularly after Gareth Bale's retirement. Now, while Edge is travelling this week, he does follow the women's game closely. As closely as anyone we know. So we asked him to give us a snapshot of his thoughts on the Matildas group for the Paris Olympics in July, August. And before I hand over to him, if you want to go to the Olympics or to enjoy some travel and combine it with one of your favourite passions, it's not too late. So in fact, it is now the time is to get onto the Green and Gold Army Tour. They've put together an unbelievable experience. You'll visit Provence in the south of France. You'll see all the Matildas games. So if you love French culture and food, then this is the tour you really want to take. You'll get to see the Matildas as well. And just imagine if, they do get to the podium finally, you'll be able to say that you were there for a very, very special occasion. Okay, well, Edge will be there, we know. So how about we hand it over to him to set the scene on what the Matildas can expect from their group.
Thanks, Rob. Yes, the Matildas and the Olympic Games. It was a big week last week with the draw for the 2024 Paris Olympics, and the Matildas, Australia, well, they've got a tough draw. They have Germany, and the United States, and also the playoff winner in the African group between Zambia and Morocco. You'd have to say that it's a bit of a group of death for the Australians. It's going to be extremely difficult. It will come down to a big first match against Germany. You would expect we would be favourites, the Matildas, to beat Zambia or Morocco. However, the match against Germany, it's been quite a while since we've played Germany, and they're sure to be very competitive in Europe, and the Australians away from home, without the home support that we received at the World Cup in Australia in 2023. It'll be interesting to see how that match plays out. And obviously the third match against the United States is going to be a crucial game for to see whether Australia can qualify for the second round. Of course, the United States going into this tournament with new coach Emma Hayes, the current Chelsea Women's Super League coach, has taken on the role of head coach at America, and they are rebuilding and in a transition phase since their disappointing round of 16 exit from the Women's World Cup in 2023, Australia, New Zealand. So the Americans will be, no doubt, have a head of steam and will be looking to make a statement at this Olympic Games. They've done so well at all Olympic Games over the journey of this the women's football at the Olympic Games. So the Americans will be tough. So the Australians, obviously without Sam Kerr, any team who loses a player of that quality is probably going to be diminished. But Michelle Heyman stood up in the qualifiers against Uzbekistan. We know Uzbekistan not of the quality of the teams that we will face in France. Yeah, it's going to be interesting. And what about the Matildas and the Olympic movement? Well, they'll be in the south of France. They'll be isolated away from the rest of the Australian Olympic team because they have matches in Marseille and Nice. If they qualify for the quarterfinals, they're likely to play that in either Lyon or Nantes or back in Marseille. So they won't actually get the Olympic Games village vibe unless they make the semi-finals or final and be scheduled to play in Paris. So that'll be an interesting experience for them. The Australians, most of the Australians, some of them who competed in 2019 in the World Cup in France, will have been to Stade de Nice. Unfortunately, that was the stadium that Australia lost to Norway in the round of 16 in 2019, a game that was marred by injury and fatigue for the Australians. So it will be interesting to see. The Olympics is a great movement. It is a fantastic event, very high profile in Australia. We know from previous commentary, Rob, that I'm a little bit sceptical of this event because only three spots are given to the Europeans, which means that five of the top 10 teams in the world won't be present. However, you've got to be in it to win it. And the Australians up against Germany, either Zambia or Morocco, and the United States, it's going to be fantastic viewing. And Australians not going on the Green and Gold Army tour will be able to watch, get up early in the morning. I think the time frames are 2, 3 and 4 a.m. in the morning. So they'll have to get up, keep the matchsticks in those eyes, Rob. I know you'll be up and watching it. And we're looking forward to what's going to be an incredible Olympic tournament. And I can't wait for the first match in Stade de Marseille when Australia will face off against Germany. It will be something to see.
So we talked about it a little off the top of the show. Derek, you've listened to what he's had to say now. Your thoughts?
Chimes with my concerns. You know, I'm obviously looking at it from a very macro lens, but Edge has gone into the finer detail here, but I just think it solidifies just how difficult an assignment this is going to be, you know, possibly the most difficult assignment. But, you know, we know these tillies can do it in major tournaments and, you know, so close in the most recent World Cup. So, you know, I have some optimism that they can ruffle a few feathers, and look, they might just be getting USA at the right time. Obviously, they've got their new manager in place. I mean, I'm fascinated to see how Emma Hayes goes. I wish her all the best, but probably not all the best when it comes to that game against Australia. It'll be fascinating.
Yep, well said. If you want to get out of here alive, support the Matildas. It's going to be a lot to look forward to. The matches we played in the early morning hours of our time, so we'll have to set the alarm. And it's going to be another one of those great tournaments, hopefully, that we get to watch. But it'll be in the middle of the Olympics, which is all the better. Derek, it's not often we do a two-hander on Box to Box these days, mate, but thanks for helping to pull it together, my friend.
Oh, no, not at all. It was good to do that, but obviously looking forward to seeing the Phyllis join us on the next one, for sure.
Absolutely. Well, you and I, we'll have Edge on stoppage time, in fact. He's going to drop a few little insights. So it'll be you and me with another sort of World Cup corner style, Edge, our man in Hong Kong, dropping in the packages. So if you've enjoyed this week, please subscribe to Box to Box, Stoppage Time and Offside, wherever you get your podcasts. Make sure, as we always say, you tweet us at Box to Box NTS and follow us on X. Like us on Facebook if you haven't already, and make sure you join us throughout the week as our podcasts drop and we go from one end of the pitch to the other in the world game.